war casualties have this long transport, sometimes 8,000 miles, two rotary wing transports, fixed wing transport, for something that in a civilian trauma center would be an elevator ride.
100 casualties at the battalion level in a LISCO fight in a major battle. What is that one surgical team going to be able to do for me? Not a lot.
You know, this is a maneuver problem. The prolonged casualty care, plain and simple, will be owned by maneuver commanders, become a logistical problem in LISCO.
This conversation is really about what happens when the golden hour goes away.
Hey, welcome back to the Modern War Institute podcast, brought to you with the generous support of the West Point class of 1974. I'm John Amble, and this episode features a discussion about a really important subject, prolonged casualty care. During its post 9/11 counterinsurgency operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, the US military had its lowest case fatality rate in history. Huge numbers of soldiers who suffered wounds that would have been fatal in any previous conflict survived because of the care they received. But that occurred because of a number of conditions that won't be present in the case of a major war, and it rested on assumptions that won't necessarily hold on a battlefield characterized by what the Army calls LISCO, large-scale combat operations. To discuss the subject, I'm joined on this episode by two Army officers with unique and valuable perspectives. Colonel Jennifer Gurney is the chief of the Department of Defense's Joint Trauma System, and Lieutenant Colonel Max Ferguson is the commander of 2nd Battalion, 14th Infantry Regiment, with recent real-world experience thinking about the issue from the perspective of a maneuver commander. We had a fascinating discussion, but before we get to it, a couple quick things. First, a very special thank you to the West Point class of 1974 for their generous support to MWI. And second, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, I hope you enjoy the conversation. Jen and Max, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the MWI podcast.
Thanks for having us, John.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So we're going to talk about an issue that I know is near and dear to both of your hearts. It's one that, you know, just as we've been talking, you've kind of impressed the importance of it on me, and that is prolonged casualty care. Listeners will have heard a little bit about you in the introduction to this episode, but, you know, Jen, maybe if we can start with you, I wonder if you can kind of maybe give the audience a sense of your background and what brought you to the point where, you know, where you're talking a lot and writing a lot about this issue, prolonged casualty care.
Yeah, you bet. Yeah, thanks so much for the opportunity. So my name is Jennifer Gurney. I'm a colonel in the U.S. Army. I'm the chief of the Joint Trauma System, which is the DOD's trauma system, which that's a whole other conversation. But since we brought it up, the U.S. military did not enter the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan with any type of trauma system. This was built over time and space by a lot of personalities that really pushed this, and we became officially established in the NDAA in 2017. So I'm an Army surgeon. I've deployed a few times. I had a chance to work with Max's team, 2nd Brigade of the 10th Mountain Division, and really have realized over time that if we're going to make real change in medicine, we have to be partnered with line and maneuver commanders. So that's how I started working with Max.
Max, I'm glad that that Jen mentioned that she had worked with you and that you're a battalion commander in 2nd Brigade, 10th Mountain Division. You're an infantry officer by trade. What brought you into, you know, I guess, thinking about this as a problem set, as an important issue?
Yeah, so, you know, it goes back to our most recent deployment to OIR, where I was in Baghdad and we had a walking blood bank. I came to the unit, they'd already established it. I wasn't familiar with the walking blood bank, but it was something that was critical to our treatment of casualties and in our planning efforts. So I started to dig into understanding what does my role one have and what is this capability and what does it mean? How do I activate it? And as I learned more about the walking blood bank and talked about it, I realized I've been in the Army for 20 years now. I have not been exposed to this concept directly. I mean, I've heard of the term, but I've never been responsible for managing it or activating one and employing it. The more I learned about walking blood banks and whole blood in the battlefield, the more I've been reflecting on the consequences of LISCO. This conversation is really about what happens when the golden hour goes away. What do we do going forward? And, you know, I've got 6 deployments. I've been striker, light infantry, ranger regiment. I've deployed under multiple things. I've seen lots of casualties on the battlefield. I've always been able to get those casualties from the point of injury back to a surgical table within that hour. Saved a lot of lives, kept a lot of amputees and, you know, permanent damage, but still alive because of the capabilities we had in the past. And as you think forward, I don't know that we're going to have those capabilities. And the more I worked with Jen on understanding whole blood, the more I understood the importance of adapting our capabilities for the future fight. And that's what this conversation is about, because it's going to be a completely different dilemma that tactical commanders like me are going to have to deal with. And how do I train and prepare not just my medics, but also my companies, my platoons, to support what will become an operational issue, not just a medical issue.
You know, one of the other podcasts that we produce at MWI is called The Spear. It's our podcast on the combat experience. For The Spear, I've had the chance to talk to dozens and dozens of people who have relayed stories of how they were wounded, how they became casualties in combat, and they kind of describe the process. Some of them don't remember the process. They say they woke up in Germany, you know, but the process of sort of tactical combat casualty care, I guess, and through these various stages of more intensive, more capable, I guess, care that they've received. You know, I guess to sort of frame this conversation, when we use the phrase prolonged casualty care, when does that begin? And I guess how long does that sort of continue?
I mean, I can start with that, and Max can be my operational translator, since I realize a lot of times medical people talk and we need operational translators. So first, I think it would be good to put in the context of what our battlefield continuum of care is, role one through role four. And role one care is essentially pre-hospital care done by medics, pre-hospital providers. You know, medics, so when I say medics, I mean all services, right? So any pre-hospital provider. Role two care, the way that we in the medical community define role two care, is forward surgical care. So damage control surgery. Role two care is a relatively new construct on the battlefield, really understood after Vietnam, realizing that casualties with severe injuries who will not be able to survive a long transport need forward surgical intervention. So forward surgical care, fast surgery, hemorrhage control, blood transfusion. Then there's role three care, which is the highest level of care on the battlefield. That's typical combat support hospital is what people think about. Role four care is the first level of care outside the battlefield, Longstuhl Regional Medical Center, which, you know, fixed wing transport from CENTCOM to Longstuhl, essentially like a CONUS-based hospital just outside the theater of operations. And then role four CONUS care, Walter Reed, BAMC, you know, big hospitals. And I think it's important to talk about that because our casualties have this long transport, sometimes 8,000 miles, two rotary wing transports, fixed wing transport, for something that in a civilian trauma center would be an elevator ride. So linking our entire trauma system from identifying the patients, moving the patients, and providing the right care. So the four rights of the joint trauma system are right patient, right time, right place, right care. And that's like, that sounds simple, but that's not simple when you're talking about large casualty volumes. Even looking back to the HCAIA MASCAL event in August of 2021, we still had challenges identifying patients, right? And that's after 20 years of having time to get better. So what happens? So what's prolonged casualty care? I mentioned I work for the joint trauma system. The joint trauma system consists of three defense committees on trauma. One of those is the Committee on Tactical Combat Casualty Care. And they're the ones that, you know, these are volunteers. So I want to give a call out to everybody who works on COTC, who put out the TC3 guidelines. And they also have a prolonged casualty care working group. You know, our community definitely recognizes the need to be able to give guidance for this. And so the official definition from the Tactical Combat Casualty Care Committee, or COTC, Committee on Tactical Combat Casualty Care, is PCC is a need to provide role one casualty care for extended periods of time when the tactical situation may limit or prevent prompt or optimal medical care. And the foundation to be able to do this well is everyone knowing how to do TC3. The reason that Max and I think got talking about this is when we were working on the whole blood project, I said to Max, you know, this is something that you own. I don't own this. I can't fix this environment. This is a non-medical space. You know, this is a maneuver problem. So prolonged casualty care, plain and simple, will be owned by maneuver commanders, become a logistical problem in LISCO, and it's really when the golden hour goes away, when you're not able to have a small medical footprint on the battlefield and transport casualties rapidly from point of injury to role two forward surgical care and then along that continuum that I just described. Max, do I need an operational interpretation of that?
Yeah, I mean, that was a great answer. I would just say it's keeping casualties alive, right? This is my job at the brigade and below level to keep my casualty alive until they get to that role three or above. And so prolonged casualty care in the olden time wasn't prolonged because it was 60 minutes or less throughout the role three. And oftentimes in the past 20 years of conflict that I spent a lot of time supporting, we bypassed our roll ones and roll twos because I, at the point of injury, at the tactical level, that platoon sustained a casualty, called in a medevac bird, and they flew straight to the roll three. We can't expect, we might get that, but we can't expect that we're going to have the environment, you know, it's going to be contested environment, air superiority, assets, you know, isolated units. We're not going to be able to get them there. Therefore, prolonged casualty care, in a nutshell, is how do I keep my casualties alive within the brigade medical capabilities long enough to get them to that proper hospital? And I'll just say right off the gate, when Jen talked about the difference describing tactical care at the company level, role one being the battalion aid station with a PA, a role two to her as a joint medical provider, she says she implies that there's a surgical capability at that role two. I'm in the Army in a BCT, the role two to me in my mindset is the Charlie Med, the medical company that my brigade has inside the BSB. And they have, you know, more beds, they have more providers, but they don't have surgical care. And so in the other services, a role two implies surgical capability. For us in the past conflicts, we've had forward surgical teams attached, you know, all different levels. When I was a Ranger company commander, I had a JMAO who had their own MH-47, and they were able to do surgery right there, you know, at the point of injury in flight. But we at the brigade level don't have surgical capabilities organically attached to us. So as an Army guy, I say role two. I think it's just my Charlie Med, more providers, more beds, more equipment. But they got a dentist, right? They got all kinds of things, radiology, they can do x-rays, they can't do surgery. And so even just defining these terms of what is a role two is super important for us because we have battalion and brigade surgeons, but they're not actually surgeons. That's just a legacy name. And so we at the Army level need to clarify what capabilities we have at echelon, and then how long can I expect as a maneuver commander for my medics, based on their proficiency, to keep those casualties alive so I can plan an operation to back all those casualties and get them to the next level of care. And that's the dilemma that I face, is understanding how long I have to coordinate that operation to get those casualties to the next level of care. And that's missing, or it's poorly defined. We can go into that further.
Yeah, and Max, you know, a dilemma that we all face, you said that's a dilemma you face, you know, a dilemma that we all face is having a standardized lexicon to really understand battlefield casualty care. So, you know, the Army is a little bit, and I've spoken with the doctrine guys about this, we're a little bit behind. I mean, the other services and NATO, you know, so if we're going to talk about a joint interoperable battlefield, we all have to have an understanding about what role two care is. And so role two care in our mind and in, you know, the other services and in NATO's mind is forward surgical care. So, you know, an area support medical company, a physical therapist and a dentist, those are great capabilities, but those aren't going to help keep a casualty alive on the battlefield. You know, it's role two surgical. So the other definitions I think are important to clarify.
You know, one of the kind of defining memories that I have of my year-long deployment in Baghdad in 2008 was we were out on patrol. We got hit by a number of IEDs. We had casualties. And so we pulled into the nearest joint security station. It was called JSS Obeidi. It was sort of on the southern edge of Sadr City in East Baghdad. It was an old cigarette factory, and it had these two tall buildings across East Baghdad. Most of the buildings were maybe two stories tall. And then we had these two that were six or eight stories tall. And just as we were rolling in the gate, we could hear and then see the medevac helicopter coming in. And it did this sort of incredible aerial maneuver to almost fly on its side to get between these two buildings and land where it needed to land. And I thought, man, that is impressive. But if you think about a totally different environment, a large-scale combat operations environment, that's great that you can fly that way, but we won't have air supremacy, and there's a very good chance that you're not going to be able to make it anywhere near that landing zone. So Max, I guess as an infantry officer, from that sort of boots-on-the-ground perspective, I wonder how you think we might have to, I guess, recalibrate our expectations of what care is going to be available for casualties on the battlefield.
Yeah, so the battle drill, you know, combat lifesaver, learned it in 2006, you know, so I'm definitely rusty in terms of, you know, what I was taught, but the business rules and practices in the past, you know, 15, 20 years of fighting was slap a tourniquet on it, pack it full of gauze, package it casually, keep them warm, prevent shock, and get them on the bird.
Pretty good. You remembered.
Yes. The problem is if the bird's not coming, then how do we evaluate those casualties and keep them alive for, I think, the realistic standard? The Army says right now in this vague standard that my medics at the, you know, should be able to keep a casualty alive for 72 hours. That, based on the training and their proficiency and what, you know, the type of wound that we can expect, is wildly aspirational and probably not the case for a majority of the severe trauma patients. I think the realistic thing is you can keep them alive for 2 to 6 hours at the battlefield. And that might include tourniquets for wounds to the extremity. If it's a wound to the chest cavity, what medical term calls non-compression torso hemorrhage, right? So I got that right. But that is basically, you can't compress it. It's a torso bleeding, chest, stomach, you know, all the places that a tourniquet doesn't fit, which is the perfect place for shrapnel to find its way around in body armor in a, you know, fight largely with fires. How do I keep that person alive? And the shift that we need to be thinking about, if I can't get them on a burden in 60 minutes, is getting them whole blood. Whole blood in the battlefield is the ability for us to keep someone who has internal bleeding, and I don't have a surgeon, I'm not able to go in there. Maybe I can pack it with gauze, but there's bleeding can't be controlled in the same way as effectively as a tourniquet could. If I've got a leaky bathtub, I got to be able to keep water in it in order to keep that volume there, and that's through whole blood. And that's where, I mean, it's just so beautifully simple. You know, I can have whole blood storage. They got these fancy backpacks. Rangers are great at using plasma and platelets and all these freeze-dried blood, but that volume isn't there for the amount of casualties we may encounter in a LISCO fight. And so one or two units in a fancy backpack is really cool if you're one period of darkness raid and you're expecting, you know, one or two casualties. But at the scale that we could expect and the time I got to keep that, you know, casualty alive, a walking blood bank where I, as a pause person, I'm able to give blood. I keep it stored. It's always fresh. I don't have to reheat it. And when I put it into somebody, because it's warm out the gate, it's the perfect medium. And you have to give them that whole blood within 36 minutes. And I say that as a general rule of thumb, right? All of these numbers are based on all kinds of factors. But based on the evidence that we have today, on the amount of casualties they've looked at, the rule of thumb that if golden hour was the old rule of thumb, the new rule of thumb needs to be 36 minutes getting somebody whole blood, and starting that blood transfusion on the battlefield is the first step at keeping casualties alive for what I think is based on Jen and her colleagues across, you know, the trauma military community, 2 to 6 hours of what I can expect to keep somebody alive before they need to get to the higher level of care. And maybe that's just damage control resuscitation at the role one, where they can do and a more life support, and they can continue on their journey back home, the casualties, to eventually a surgical table.
And that's not going to save. So a couple points. So Max, really well said, you know more about medical than some medical people. So great job, seriously. But you know, when you said that about being the bank, like you are the bank. So the walking blood bank, the person who's the donor is the bank. And that's kind of, because this is a term that we're also, you know, that NATO has adopted, and that's kind of been a hard sell because we think of blood banking as something different, but that's a whole other discussion. But, you know, so in that 2 to 6 hours, we've really thought about that, you know, talked with a bunch of other trauma experts, because we don't do that experiment, right? How can we keep somebody alive who's bleeding to death when they're not getting hemorrhage control? Because really the precedent is blood transfusion and hemorrhage control. And if you can't control hemorrhage, so, you know, NCTH, non-compressible torso hemorrhage, so hemorrhage in the abdomen or pelvis, what can you do as a golden hour extender? So that's what we're really looking for in PCC, is what can we do to extend the golden hour, and how can we empower pre-hospital providers? So it's not just going to be blood transfusion. It's a whole bunch of other things. But if we're talking about people who are bleeding to death, those casualties that we were able to save and have the lowest case fatality rate in history, it's blood transfusion. And so empowering that down to the level of role one providers and ensuring that everyone is trained and manned and equipped to be able to do transfusion at that level will save lives on the battlefield, like unquestionably.
We've had incidents in the Army. I'm thinking of the Battle of Kop Keating in Afghanistan in 2009, where blood transfusion saved lives. But at Kop Keating, that was only possible because the battalion PA happened to be at the COP and knew how to do it. He used his own blood. But that's really kind of relying on good fortune. It was, I guess, rare for a unit, especially a company-sized unit, to have that knowledge and capability. And I think it still is. So what would be required now to make sure that in a LISCO environment, say there's an incident with multiple casualties where we can't evacuate them immediately, what would be required so that we could make use of these walking blood banks?
So two things. One, pre-screening. We need to pre-screen every service member to understand their blood type and what their titers level are. And Max really talked about this in detail in his paper. And then the second thing is training. This needs to be trained like anything else. Blood transfusion, if done wrong, has a risk. So we need to be sure that everybody's getting trained on that. Donor screening, and that's been a bit of a challenge to get that paid for. We have it as a requirement, but we're a little bit behind. The Army's a little bit behind and who's going to pay for donor screening? You know, is it going to be the Defense Health Agency? Is it going to be units? Is it going to be the services? But donor screening and training would be the short answer. And then Max, if you want to elaborate on that.
Yeah, so I think that it's great that across the formation, what, 40% of people are O type blood, which is the universal donor. And then Jen, you'll tell me that another 40% are A blood type, which is another useful common number. But the problem is you can have all the blood and the proficiency is really easy. We think it's overcomplicated, but if you can stick someone with an IV, you've basically got the basic capabilities to do a walking blood bank from a like potential skill set. But you're right, it takes training and the screening, because there's two things. One is the blood type. Okay, so you're O pos or O neg. One, it's not just O neg. O pos can do it too, and that's the common form. A lot of people are O pos, so that's a useful thing to have. But then this idea of titer screening is something that I can't do rapidly. So I can test you in 5 minutes using Eldon kit, which is just a little finger prick, and they say, yep, okay, we know your blood type, but you had to be really careful about the titers, which is this other thing that takes a while for labs to test.
What is that?
Jen, go ahead. Please do a better job than
me. So, you know, there's four different blood groups, A, B, AB, and O. And so you have natural titers. Everyone has titers. So if you're, it's too complicated to explain, but like if I'm type A, I have anti-B antibodies. If you're type B, you have anti-A antibodies. That's just the way that we're made. Type O has anti-A and anti-B antibodies. However, it's the universal donor because of the way that the red cells look. But the way that it's the universal donor for other types of blood when it's whole blood is you have to be low titer. Otherwise, there's a risk of hemolysis. So that, those titers being tested before you deploy and knowing your blood type before you deploy, that's crucial. And it's easy. And we do a bunch of other tests before we deploy. So adding on donor screening tests, so you have your walking blood bank roster figured out. When I was downrange with 210 on the PDSS, these Roll One medics, they were on top of this. They recognized the importance of this life-saving capability, and they had rosters. They had the Eldon cards tested. They were so on top of this, knowing that if it ever came to be that they had to do a walking blood bank, they wanted to be ready. The Rangers have done this during firefights. I mean, this is something that with the right training, conventional units up to special mission units can do this, and it can save lives. It's not something that you can just make the assumption can be done without training, and it certainly cannot be done safely without blood typing and titer testing beforehand.
Yeah, and I'll say that. So when I was in Baghdad most in this last deployment, we had all done our titer testing as a brigade. So there's 200 of us from our brigade on this base of 1,500 people. And we were the only ones that had been tested. So even if there were other Americans and we were comfortable, we hadn't been tested. And overseas, you can only do the blood type. You can't do the titer testing because you have to send the sample back. It requires a lab. It's not something you can do field expedient. The tech doesn't exist. And so it happened to be there were 30 of us in this base that was also responsible for security. We were the only 30 that happened to be eligible for whole blood. So if there was a mass cow, whether it was a rocket strike, drone strike, or just whatever, a fire, accidental environmental risk, something happened, the only people that were eligible to give walking blood bank, because we were the only ones that tested because we chose to out of our operations and maintenance funds prior to deploying, were the same people that are supposed to be guarding the walls and providing the first response, which is ironic because you got all these people in a rear echelon type base where you got all these staffers that are perfectly suited, if nothing else, come into the aid station, and you probably are capable, but we weren't able to test you because it's not standard for American units to get this titer testing prior to going overseas. So it's super simple. We're already drawing blood. We're already sticking you. We're already testing for HIV and all these other things. Just add to that mix the whole blood testing, and then you have this Excel file, and it doesn't change. If anything, if you're high titer as a younger age, it probably gets better over time. So once you're low titer, odds are right now we expect you to remain that way. So just get your blood type, because it's really important to not mess that up, because you can have the blood poisoning and the rejection if you accidentally do it. And Jen's absolutely right. The Rangers have been doing this for a long time. They call it ROLO, and they've been doing it where you're in a firefight. There's a CCP at the platoon level. They call, hey, we need a blood bank because someone needs blood. Ranger comes in. They stick him. They draw the blood. He's back on the fight within 10 minutes because they have that battle drilled down. And that's the proficiency that needs to be trained by guys like me at the operational level where we activate the call. Those people know who they are. They know exactly the steps. The medics stick them. They collect the blood, and then they go back to the front lines and get back into the fight. So it's not like I'm losing that fighter for that donor. I just need to be able to identify who they are and get them back there, which is at the platoon level. There'll be a handful of guys. But when it's a larger area, we got to make sure that we understand who is eligible. And the wider the population, the more I can choose which ones I want to activate and how much blood I need to pull for that casualty.
And then those rosters get identified before, you know, way early. So Ranger Rolo, Ranger Olo Titero, so their Rolos are identified. Everyone in the unit knows who they are. They carry a Rolo card identifying them. And they're always sure that when they go out on mission that they have one or two Rolos with them.
I think that that this is sort of the most obvious challenge as we shift gears toward kind of a LISCO environment in terms of our mindset, is that we're going to have higher numbers of casualties and we're going to need to be able to provide some sort of care right there where the casualty is suffered. But if we zoom out, you know, I guess if we just kind of go one step further in the casualty care process to the role two facilities, I guess at the brigade level, you know, every brigade has a surgeon. And I just learned as we were chatting before we started recording that a brigade surgeon is not necessarily a surgeon. Is that something that, you know, that I guess we're going to have to change or rethink in terms of, you know, I guess making decisions about how far forward we put surgical capabilities in order to give casualties that next level of care?
You know, for sure. So if we're going to be serious about saving lives on the battlefield, not only do we have to lean into prolonged casualty care, and there's a quote, if I could just read this quote from the prolonged casualty care position statement from the PCC working group. The willingness to adopt PCC across the full range of military operations demonstrates an unwavering commitment to continually improve battlefield survivability for our force, an unwillingness to accept any gaps in the continuum of care. So that's, you know, but the other thing we have to lean into, and so the golden hour is going to be very hard to achieve, like we talked about before. But something that we're learning about in the Ukraine experience and that is that in some situations, the golden hour definitely exists. And that's if you move a roll two forward surgical team very close to where the fighting is. I think one of the things is we don't have enough surgical teams to really be able to do this. I think that's one thing that's like the big elephant in the room. Do we have enough forward surgical teams to be able to handle LISCO? In the Army, we've got 49. And we're not, you know, more of those are in the reserve and guard component than in the active component. So we do have to rethink it. We have to understand the continuum of care and that two things need to happen if we really want to save lives on the battlefield for those casualties that are bleeding: hemorrhage control and whole blood transfusion. Another golden hour extender, which we won't get into much, is the need for having freeze-dried plasma or dried plasma far forward. That's another golden hour extender. But I do think we have to rethink the battlefield continuum and move capability closer to the point of injury. When we can't do that, we've got to ensure that TC3 is being implemented and so is prolonged casualty care. And the goal of prolonged casualty care is to get that casualty, get that unit, get that team out of the prolonged casualty care environment and move them along the established battlefield continuum.
You know, for a guy like me, and they tell me I got a surgical team attached to my company, battalion, whatever, that makes me feel good. You know, it gives me more confidence that I can go and lock horns with the enemy and I can be more aggressive because I know that there's that, you know, realistic capability of getting those guys the proper level of care. But at the macro scale, macro being battalion and brigade level, say I have a surgical team make it a real role two at the brigade level. Charlie Med is augmented with one or two surgical teams, or at the battalion level, I have a role one, but they pushed me some kind of forward surgical team. That is not as simple as, okay, check the block, move on, milestone complete. I can now, you know, assume more risk because the size of that team, the number of beds, the capability is there. They might be the best surgeons ever. How much class eight they have, how many, you know, how big is their team? And so their capacity might still only be good enough for one or two surgical patients, right? So at the company level, battalion level, you know, 500, 600, 700 people, and we're in some kind of like HE fight where there's now, you know, dozens, you know, 100 casualties at the battalion level in a LISCO fight in a major battle. What is that one surgical team going to be able to do for me? Not a lot. Not a lot in the expectation of they might be the best surgeons ever. How much class A do they have and how many people can they actually affect? And so there is also this like expectation management of, okay, great, I got a surgical team. I have two beds. You know, how many, not just can I perform the surgery, but then can I keep them alive, you know, in ICU and the amount of attention? And it's not just the surgeon, it's the team and all the support staff that they have, because I might have a surgeon and he or she might be awesome, but do my medics know how to support them? And have they been experienced in keeping those patients alive, again, for 24 plus hours before I can get them to that next level of care? Do I have the right equipment to do that? And there's only a couple things like an ultrasound, you know, and these, there's some very basic things that we could, you know, push our role ones and our role twos to ensure that they have the ability to even perform that, even if they have the experience and the knowledge, do they have the equipment and do they have the supplies? And the further forward you go, you can expect that they're going to have less supplies because they're going to need to be light and mobile because they're going to have to be able to move. And so you don't want this massive, you know, guy showing up with Pelican cases, you know, filling the back of an LMTV for a company, because it's just not realistic in terms of the ability to keep them moving on the battlefield to keep them alive.
And small surgical teams in COIN have done, you know, great things, but it was for one or two patients at a time. You know, looking at the casualty load, these teams will get task saturated very quickly. We've looked at this a lot at the Joint Trauma System. There's a position statement about the risks of single surgeon teams and small surgical teams. There's no question that they can do stuff, but for LISCO and huge numbers of casualties, units will be assuming a lot of risk. Commanders will be assuming a lot of risk if they think that they can manage large numbers of severely injured casualties. One severely injured casualty could tax out a small surgical team. There's a great quote from over 100 years ago, and in every talk I give on this, I use it. It's from Ogilvy from the late 1800s. Good surgery must be done as far forward as possible. If it's too good in the sense of too elaborately equipped, it will not be far forward enough. And if it's too far forward, it will not be good enough. I mean, that's the real dilemma that is, you know, going back to Napoleon's War was recognized. You want to bring the capabilities far forward, but if you have the capability that you need, it's not going to be nimble, agile, and equipped enough to be able to be in that, you know, contested space.
I guess what it sounds like I'm hearing, and correct me if I'm wrong, but does that mean that there is no right answer, and that in effect, the right answer is making situation-dependent, environment-specific decisions in each tactical case?
100%, which is why we have to integrate a trauma system and have an agile, adaptive trauma system that can be responsive to whatever the threat is on the battlefield, like really being threat informed and understanding where the risk is and being able to move teams and being able to understand the system where the capability is. You know, really, like I said, those four rights of a trauma system, the right patient to the right place at the right time that can deliver the right care. It sounds simple, but it's not. But when you have a trauma system that's integrated with the maneuver force, that's how you really support the battlefield. And another thing that I think we have to think about for LISCO or any type of large scale combat operations is from a medical perspective, we're not going to really help win the war. We can help with morale. We can help with data, all this stuff. But man, if we have a horrible medical system that fails, we will bleed out combat power and we can contribute to a lot of loss during any conflict.
And John, I'll just say from my perspective, there's two sides of this that's really important. One is just the humanitarian. I want to make sure that we are best postured to keep people alive just for the life-saving mindset. But in a LISCO fight, there's a second, more pragmatic issue that's also addressed in how we approach prolonged casualty care, and that's reconstitution. Preserving combat power, making sure that we still can sustain the fight after the first battle, because if we're not properly trained, equipped, and in the mindset to focus on how to keep these patients alive, we'll either apply tourniquets that aren't necessary, and then we'll lose limbs and create problems down the road for their long-term health, because having a tourniquet on for an hour is different than having a tourniquet on for 10 hours. And what happens to not just the limb, but also the liver functions and everything else and the kidney functions. So the internal organs start to suffer, and therefore dialysis and all kinds of long-term issues. But those soldiers potentially could come back into the fight, right? If I didn't have to put on the tourniquet and I knew how to stabilize that casualty, maybe it would take a couple weeks or a couple months, but I could get that soldier back into the fight, which in a LISCO, you know, fight we're seeing right now, you know, years into the Ukraine battle, the combat power preservation is a huge component for our ability to win these long-term enduring conflicts. And so PCC is as much about saving lives, mostly saving lives, but there is also a secondary conversation about preservation of combat power and reconstitution and how much, you know, people will have to go back, return to duty in LISCO in order to win this fight in the long run.
You know, one of the challenges that we have in the Army is that anytime we talk about a problem or an issue, those conversations, they certainly tend to start, and sometimes they remain within particular communities. Everybody in the Army is part of a branch. You're part of a unit. You're part of a command. And those become, you know, I don't want to say echo chambers, but they become the communities where discussions take place. And it can be difficult to kind of break free of those boundaries. And yet the thing we're talking about, the subject of each of those discussions, it can potentially impact everybody. I think that challenge is magnified. It becomes even more daunting when we're talking about medicine, right? This highly specialized field where members of that community are experts. They went to school for a long time, and a lot of their conversations are difficult even to comprehend because it's an entirely different lexicon, for instance. How do you kind of, you know, I guess, how do you overcome those boundaries and take the discussions that, you know, Jen, that you're having in the meetings and the conferences and the other places where you go and you're talking about this, how do you take them out into the operational force?
We have to be linked line in medical, maneuver in medical, to be talking about this, you know, because you're, John, you're right. We stay in our own silos, and there is real risk to force if guys like Max don't really understand medical capabilities. It's more than just a sustainment function. Once the trauma system goes down on the battlefield, all other warfighting functions will be threatened. I mean, I have strong opinions. I think that I've been trying to message line and maneuver commanders ever since I realized as a medical provider, like, you guys own this. Like, all this medical care, if we're not linked with you, we are not going to get better. We essentially work for you. Unlike in the civilian trauma system where I work for civilian medical people, in the military, we work for operational commanders. And us understanding each other and medical guys being able to speak your language, I mean, not to Max, because he clearly knows medical language, but like, you know, to other is important. That's how we save lives and really act as a force enabler.
It's interesting, right? If the right decision on where to place a forward surgical team is, you know, if that decision needs to be made based on conditions on the ground, then you're sort of requiring that brigade commander or battalion commander, that tactical leader, to understand enough about this to make the best decision. And, you know, I guess maybe we kind of took it for granted in Iraq and Afghanistan and didn't have to make decisions like that because there was an infrastructure in place. Anytime you went outside the wire, you knew, I mean, you probably saw the medic that was accompanying you if you had that. But you knew that if you went down, you were going to be taken care of, that there was a process for this stuff. And yet if that process has to be more fluid and based on conditions on the battlefield, then those decisions have to be made by, in all likelihood, a maneuver brigade or battalion commander that hasn't had a lot of experience making those kinds of decisions. Max, you know, I guess I'd love to hear your perspective as somebody who's been forced to think about this at that level.
But I'll say I've only been thinking about this for a year, right? In terms of, I will gladly show my ignorance and ask the dumb questions on behalf of the, you know, whatever small percentage, maybe a lot of people already know all this stuff and they're like, Max, I got it. Everything we're talking about is super intuitive. Everything we're talking about is something that anyone who just takes a second to think about is like, yep, this all makes sense. I get it. I see the problem too. The only thing I want to do is take the conversation out of the medical community that have been wrestling with this and understanding this and seeing this for a long time and put it where the conversation needs to be, which is in the operational community, because that's exactly the community that's actually going to, one, own it, and two, help solve it. So everything we're also talking about is a really low cost, high return on investment shift in a little bit of training, a little bit of mindset, a little bit of planning factors. I'm not saying that we got to buy this $1 billion B2, you know, jet in order to fix this problem. It's just adapting to what we intuitively know is coming and thinking about how we're going to shift our planning factors, which is me at the commander, you know, tactical commander level, all I need to know, right? I understand fires. I understand sustainment. I think about burn rates of fuel, you know, how much ammo I'm consuming for, you know, indirect fire. This is just another planning consideration that has been vaguely codified. So therefore, I've just assumed that my medics know it. Simple concepts like tourniquet conversion. I asked Jen, I was like, hey, what exactly, explain that to me, because I mean, I could just break it down again intuitively and think, okay, it's taking the tourniquet off. But who does that, right? Like, is that a CLS, you know, is that a line guy's job, or is that my medic's job? Is that something that only a surgeon can do, or a PA? Like, I can get the idea of it, but we should go just a couple more inches deep for a guy like me, the maneuver team, to understand, you know, what are the capabilities and who is responsible for this. So I think just learning some of these basic terms, like, okay, we just talked about titers. It's a weird concept. We haven't talked about that before, but it's totally easy to grasp. you know, and then understanding some of these basic planning factors goes a long way. And it doesn't require a lot of money. There's a little bit of equipment. I'd love to have more surgeons, but in the absence of more surgeons, let's at least have a pragmatic understanding of what my capabilities are within what I have and work with what I have. I'm in the 10th Mountain Division, right? So we are aspiring to be true light infantry, get rid of our vehicles, R-Struck's helping that. And now we got to talk about fighting in rugged, austere, and isolated terrain. An isolated terrain could be something, you know, actually on the side of a mountain or deep, you know, engaged with the enemy, or it can just be isolated because I'm in one farming village and this is where my company's fighting from. And I can't get, you know, 5 kilometers to the rear because the enemy's got me zeroed in and I have to fight within these buildings because in this little hamlet that I'm in. What sears in my mind for the example of to think about is a World War II battle called the Battle of Mortain, where 2nd Battalion of the 120 Infantry, a motorized unit, right? And so you think I'm light infantry, so it's, you know, stuck in my brain because I don't have all these vehicles. A striker unit might feel more comfortable. Ground Kazovac, I'll figure it out. And so they'll kind of wish it away because, you know, they've got trans always in their disposal, so it'll just buff out. But the truth is, 2nd Battalion of the 120 in the Battle of Mortain was a motorized unit who was told to hold this hill. And for 6 days, they were isolated. They could see, you know, the rear, but they just physically couldn't get off of it. And the casualty they took, this one battalion on this hilltop, guys were groaning in the middle of the night and dying of sepsis. And that's something that you talk about eroding the morale of your team, of thinking about 100 people in your CCP isolated just a couple kilometers away is all they need to get supplies. And they were so desperate, they were taking out alum rounds and packing it with Class 8 and trying to fire Class 8 onto their own friendly positions to resupply them with medical supplies, morphine, right? Just to keep these guys and some gauze because they ran out of gauze. 100 casualties sitting in the CCP isolated for 6 days and people were groaning to death in the middle of the night. If I'm in a foxhole and my buddy can't get help and we are not proficient at keeping these guys alive, that will erode the morale and that will have second, third order consequences in terms of casualties. And so isolated terrain in a contested environment can be for all types of units. And in this day and age with, you know, one-way attack drones, everyone, the front line isn't the only element. We were seeing strikes, you know, hundreds of kilometers away, you know, when we were in OIR for the drone strike. So it is something that needs to be considered. Physical isolation, also just the ability for isolated from supplies. And so as a commander, if I'm going to backhaul casualties, I'm going to tie it to forward pushing of supplies. And so nothing's going to come in without something going out. It's a deliberate operation. And I need my medical team to say, yep, boss, you've got 24 hours before the majority of these casualties expire. Okay, my planning factor is 24 hours. You know, in, you know, 22 hours, I'm going to coordinate this mission and I'm going to concentrate mass resources to allow those supplies to come in. And in the same breath, evacuate those casualties back. And that is an operational function. That is what I'm considering, and it is more than just you know, my medic's problem. That is now in the operational side to figure out to time that, and I just need to know how much time I got, right? How much time do I have this aircraft on station? How many rounds do I have left? How much time do I have is the first step of figuring out the decisions I have to make in order to get those casualties out of the rear and prevent sepsis from kicking in, which is going to be the next biggest thing that we haven't been talking about and haven't had to deal with in past conflicts.
You know, in the Army, we have lots and lots of enablers, capabilities that aren't typically organic to a maneuver unit, for example, but can be used to augment that unit. But there's this maxim, right? Train as you fight. I think everybody intuitively understands that we'll make better operational, real-world use of those enablers if we've had a chance to work with them, to train with them. Is this something, I guess, that would similarly benefit from adhering to that maxim? Are there opportunities to give brigade and battalion command teams and staffs more exposure to, say, surgical teams, maybe during a CTC rotation, so that it isn't a consideration that you don't really have to confront until you're, you know, essentially boots on the ground?
I mean, there's a lot to talk about in terms of like the preparation lead up for this. At the tactical side, you know, what the CTCs evaluate us on and give us credit for is what we're going to prepare for and train for. So I know that the CTCs are adapting how they're evaluating casualties, and are the CTCs giving you credit for demonstrating, not just like hand waving, here's a blood transfusion kit in my hand, therefore I give blood transfusion. But if you can talk through, and if the OCs are actually evaluating their ability to perform a walking blood bank and reinforce that culture, then they'll be able to do it. when it comes to the forward surgical teams at the, you know, battalion or brigade level, wherever they're at in the battlefield, not only are the maneuver leaders understanding of the capabilities, right, true capabilities and limitations, constraints and requirements in order to employ that, and, you know, the amount of beds and the type of casualties and training them, is that team trained together, right? And this is where I would never send a platoon to combat without doing platoon live fires. When there's a Abrams crew, they do gunnery in the armor community. Gunnery is a huge thing. They lock in that crew, and that crew, like that, you know, platoon sergeant may have done this 15, 20 times in his or her career, but now as a crew, they are certified. Are the surgeons super proficient, knowledgeable, extremely capable, but do the whole team, the 6 to 20 people on that surgical team, have they trained together in a, not just, okay, high five orientation, let's talk about each other's names and our hobbies, but actually performed surgeries in some kind of realistic sense before they deploy, and that way they are certified? Because I'll tell you, and Jen will probably jump on this, those surgical teams are pickup games, and we, you know, just throw them together and send them overseas, and they'll figure it overseas. That is not the time I want them, because I wouldn't send a platoon with a bunch of seasoned squad leaders and platoon sergeant, all these, you know, people that have done this before somewhere else, and say, okay, go do a maneuver, you know, against the enemy at night and on familiar terrain. That's not how it works in any other kind of combat scenario. So we should be certifying those crews together as a team before they go overseas. And that's just internal to that surgical team. And ideally they've trained with, and there is a familiarity of the employment considerations with the unit that they will be attached to. So there's lots of different things to be thinking about before they actually go forward.
John, going back to your question before about kind of the battlefield construct and the trauma system on there, you were talking about brigade surgeons and how to inform this. You know, expertise and experience. When you guys have a brigade surgeon, and if they're a, you know, primary care doctor, psychiatrist, dentist, nurse, if they don't have experience and expertise in trauma systems, and I, you know, it's hard to say this and not come across as like an arrogant surgeon, but you really need the right people in this. You guys do that. You recognize talent management, and not to say that a brigade surgeon isn't incredibly, if they're a, you know, primary care doctor or a psychiatrist, not to say that they're not very good at certain command elements, but understanding trauma capability and battlefield trauma systems, they don't get trained in it and they don't know it. And we've been lucky in COIN operations that we've had air superiority, rapid evac, you know, good comms. That is not assumed for the future battlefield. So having leaders who understand trauma capability, role two capability, role one, and what a trauma system looks like, that's how we really support the maneuver element. And you can't just throw people into these jobs and say, you know, you graduated from a residency, you have doctor after your name, you are a brigade surgeon. But that's what we do. And you guys not knowing, and I've worked for, you know, very senior leaders who had no idea that their task force med commander was not a surgeon and not even a doctor for that matter. So, I mean, I think that you guys, that, you know, these conversations are important so we can all learn to communicate better, and that we also learn to speak your language. If you guys don't think that, you know, you guys need to ask the questions about expertise and battlefield planning for trauma systems.
I'll say one more thing about the, you know, battalion or brigade surgeons. So in this last deployment, I've had ProFiz docs attached to me throughout multiple, you know, deployments over the years. I had a great one attached to me this last one, Doc Holweg. He was an internal medicine doc. And I would ask him, okay, like, tell me your background. He's like, oh, I'm internal medicine. I've done blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, what are the typical types of ProFiz docs that, you know, we get augmented with? And they're either an internal medicine doc or a family practice doc are usually the ones, you know, but it could be an OBGYN. It could be all kinds of random things, a medical doctor of some capacity, they get pushed to us. And so in my mind, I'll be honest. I don't know what an internal medicine doctor does, right? Even to this day, I don't really know what he does. But I'm like, okay, he's worked in an ER and he's an internal medicine doc. That must mean if I get shot in the stomach, he'll be able to at least go in and kind of pull out the bullet and tighten me up and stabilize me and go forward. Because internal medicine, or whatever that is, right?
Says no.
But that's what I think.
No, but you're right. Yeah, I know. And that's why we have a failure to communicate. We have a failure to communicate capabilities. And we either we're not communicating them or you're not understanding them. But I think it's on us. I think we have a failure to communicate. And not having that expertise at every level, you know, at battalion, brigade, division, is going to, you know, bring some risk. So that's one of the reasons we're having this conversation. I mean, Max, when you guys realized some of this stuff, we started talking more and we've both learned from each other. And I think these conversations need to happen more between, you know, line leaders and medical leaders.
Well, I hope that this podcast will be a part of that conversation. If we zoom out a bit, then, you know, we've talked about a number of ways in which the system as currently constructed and conceptualized is insufficient for the challenges ahead. But what are the biggest things, I guess, that hamper the Army's ability to adapt the system, or really the Joint Forces' ability to do so? Is it personnel and manpower? Is it training? Is it doctrine? Is it the communication challenges that we mentioned, these sort of siloed conversations? What are the biggest hurdles to overcome?
I'll talk at the tactical level and then I'll let Jen go beyond my scope. So I'll just say the brigade level. One is, you know, the past 20 years, over time, our medics and our soldiers were more proficient. So the casualty, you know, support was better because they had been exposed to trauma patients to really bad combat injuries throughout their career from their junior age. So they had just more experience. That experience is waning, naturally. That's a good thing. I'm glad that in a very holistic sense that our medics have had less exposure because that means less people are getting hurt. But how do we replicate that experience so that way, you know, we can do cadavers and we can do, you know, live tissue labs with animals and all those kind of things in the Mystic centers where they have the, you know, simulation. Those are great. But there's also this idea of there's nothing like being in a ER, seeing somebody actually a human being, a live human being fighting for their life. And we can, you know, so the idea is like ride-alongs. Oh, have them run around with EMTs. But also, you know, going to trauma centers across the country, there is, you know, rural health and how many people are, you know, would love to have additional support, but there's legal practice and all these other things. The thing to be thinking about is like, if I send them to some like hospital in Boston or Chicago or Atlanta, where there's going to be gunshot wounds and stabbings and all these other things, it's almost an artificial condition because in that level one trauma center in a major city, they have all of the capabilities. They've got MRIs, CAT scans, all of the systems. But somewhere more rural, like a level three trauma center in some small city in an area where there's one doc and his job or her job is to stabilize a patient, to life flight them somewhere else, that's the role one, role two experience. That's the bubblegum and shoestrings kind of, you know, practices that our medics are best served to learn from. So getting our medics real world experience, and there's plenty of places across the country or around these military bases, especially like Fort Drum, all over northern New York, it'd be great to have my medics spend not just one or two nights in a ride-along where they may or may not see something, but a true experience in a level three type civilian trauma center where they're having to do more with less and learn from these docs. The other side on the tactical side for me is not just exposing my medics to that level of intensity and that level of injury, but also across the force, understanding this whole blood program and making sure that my individual platoons and companies are proficient at providing whole blood in the battlefield. At the SRP, you know, we do it, you know, before pre-deployment activities, making sure that we're actually screening people for whole blood. So that way we not just have the skill set, but we have identified who those people are who are able to do it. And then just common terms, right? What is a surgeon? I think we should drop this battalion brigade surgeon unless you're actually able to perform surgery. And just something as simple as redefining these terms and making sure that, you know, there's nothing wrong with being a PA. I think they're awesome. They do tons of God work for us. But we should be focusing at the tactical level at damage control resuscitation and making sure that my PA at the battalion level and my medics are capable of performing those things to keep those organs and that volume of blood in the body so that way they can continue to stay alive to the next level. And then if you can do damage control surgery, understanding the limitations of that. And so at the tactical level, it's understanding the capabilities, limitations, who can do what, and just managing my expectations and give me realistic time standards for me to plan the operation going forward. That's at the tactical level.
And Jen, if we zoom out sort of more broadly.
Yeah, I mean, I just, Max, I really appreciate you and what you've learned and what you've taught me. But I do think so at every level, tactical, operational, and strategic, experience saves lives. Experience saves lives, and we've got to get every level of provider experience. Max was focusing on the medics, but you can talk about that for all levels of providers. And if we're honest, the military health system is in crisis right now because we're not getting that experience in our MTFs. We're really leveraging MilSIV partnerships, but all that experience. At the operational and strategic level, we have to understand the importance of a learning healthcare system on the battlefield. And that learning healthcare system on the battlefield requires appropriate leadership and adopting the trauma system concepts. When I talked about already, right patient, right time, right place, right care, easy to say, hard to implement. We're working in the, each one of the combatant commands to set up frameworks for the combatant command trauma system. So that's having these frameworks to really support a data-driven healthcare system, which is done with, we didn't really talk about this much, but setting up frameworks for performance improvement and medical performance optimization in every combatant command with trauma medical directors who have oversight and work with the command, we say surgeons, but command maybe the, you know, medical operation commanders, you know, to work with them in each one of the combatant commands to ensure that these frameworks are being implemented. And then at the strategic level, really embracing the concepts of the joint trauma system, having leadership communicate the appropriate risk, looking at the battlefield laydown and the medical concept of operations, how it links with the evacuation priorities, and then using data that's generated from the care of every casualty, from the pre-hospital environment with the tactical combat casualty care card or the 1380, all the way through role 4 care. Every time a patient or casualty gets taken care of, that's documented. That data goes into the Department of Defense Trauma Registry. And I know we didn't really talk about this, but you know, that data being generated goes into our registry. We use it for medical performance optimization, which is using that data to inform doctrine, organization, training, materiel, personnel, and leadership. And so that's really at the strategic level. And only when we're talking about these things and maneuver commanders like Max and some of the other people I've been privileged to work with understand the importance of a trauma system and how it's implemented, you know, at the tactical, operational, strategic level, and the importance of training, education, leadership, and communication about this, then we're going to really be able to implement a battlefield trauma system that's going to support maneuver commanders, keep people in the fight, enhance return to duty, have rapid education, and really, you know, rapidly optimize. You know, we talk, I just want to say one more thing. We talk about our lowest case fatality rate in history in COIN, and that's great. And we have it. That's true. And that is an incredible accomplishment that we should be proud of. However, it took us about 3 years to really make that change. It took us 3 years of an unacceptable number of death from survivable injury in U.S. service members to really start changing that. And we're not going to have that time in LISCO. We see this. We work with the Ukrainians a lot. We get to hear from their experiences. And if we don't implement these things now, then we're going to just, it is going to impact combat power, return to duty, and impact warfighting functions. So that's kind of my probably too long answer.
No, it's great. To be honest, you know, this is one of those episodes where I'm really struggling to kind of keep it short, I guess. We usually try to record for no more than an hour or so. And I'm struggling to do that because I feel like every time one of you says something, there's this new sort of thread that I want to pull on further. We do have to stop somewhere. And before we do, you know, just because it is such an important subject, I want to make sure that it's as complete a discussion as we can have in this format in about an hour. So is there anything else that we haven't touched on that you think is just important to note?
John, the only thing that I think that is worth highlighting is this: we're I'm an Army officer, so is Jen. So we're talking Army, and I just want to keep my scope of what's appropriate. So I'll talk about the tactical level, and I'll talk about the Army because that's where I serve and that's where I come from. But this is not just an Army ground force problem, and we had some really great contributions from some Navy medical folks that Jen works with, and it is just as relevant for surface warfare officers and the likelihood of sustaining significant casualties on a destroyer or some other naval ship, and the limitations for surgical care and the limitations and the need for a walking blood bank on a ship is just as relevant as a company or a battalion, you know, fighting in Eastern Europe or out in the Pacific. So it would be a shame to box this into an Army problem with two Army officers, three, you know, counting yourself, you know, Army background folks, and saying this is an Army issue. This is a joint issue, and you know, air bases are going to have the same issues where they're going to be targeted, and there's likelihood for mass casualties at an air base, you know, somewhere in theater, and the Navy for sure is behind the duck, just like the rest of us are in understanding the requirements for prolonged casualty care for both at sea, on land, for the ground force, and for anyone who's in a theater, because the enemy can now range us with cheap, fast, or cheap, slow, but long-range munitions. And so the idea of a mass cal and needing to treat casualties before we can set the conditions for an evacuation apply to all services.
Yeah, no, you know, that's a great reminder. This is not just an Army issue. But I do think we are going to wrap up there. Max and Jen, I want to thank you both so much for taking the time and for coordinating your schedules across time zones so that we could have a really, really fascinating and I think really important conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing, if you aren't yet following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.